All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Fortune's Wheelhouse, numeric episode number 7, coronavirus edition. We are all at home quarantining. And in fact, Mel and I were going to meet to record in person, but thought the better of it. And I hope all of you listening at home are staying well during this difficult time. But we're glad we can be here with you in your ear holes and trying to explore the mysteries as we do each time you tune in. All right, so we're here to explore number 7. Number 7 and number 8 actually go together, so we will be recording them together, though you'll be getting them 2 weeks apart. For number 7, we are, of course, dealing with the 4 numeric minors that are sevens. So the 7 of Wands, which is valor, the 7 of Cups, which is debauch or illusionary success, the 7 of Swords, which is futility or unstable effort, and the 7 of Discs or Pentacles, which is failure or success unfulfilled, Mel's least favorite card. And then,
I say as of yet.
Exactly.
Unfulfilled as of yet, because I don't give up.
Nevertheless, she persisted.
Yes.
And then we have also the majors, major arcana by number and reduced, which gives us the Chariot and the Tower. So let's get started on some of the numeric associations of 7, I guess, which is unbelievable.
It's huge.
There's so many.
Yeah, 7's just such an interesting number.
We have our 7 planets, traditionally, our 7 days of the week, our 7 notes, our 7
it's
colors.
It's the last prime of our series in the numeric series. And it's like, the 7 musical notes, the 7 planets. I have a whole list of things. Metals, the 7 seals, the 7 archangels, the 7 orifices in your head. The 7 chakras, the 7 stages of life. Those are really interesting.
Those are really interesting,
7 years of bad luck when you break the mirror of Venus, because as we will be discussing, 7 is the number associated with Venus.
Right.
The 7 gates of Inanna's descent. The 7 rungs of the ladder of enlightenment. There's like all sorts of really cool things associated with 7.
Mm-hmm. 7 hells and 7 heavens.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the 7 ages of man, which I think is especially interesting.
Yeah.
Have you run across the thing where they sort of ascribe each stage to a planet?
To a planet, yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So the moon is infancy, right?
Yep.
And Mercury is childhood, and you know, where you're first a school kid, basically gaining knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And then Venus is the age of love and youth, when you're a young
person just blooming into puberty, I imagine.
Yes, exactly. And then the sun as well. I've seen it as manhood, womanhood, to
adulthood, I guess.
Yeah,
we could say.
You know, and they also kind of think of that as the stage of reproduction. Marriage and reproduction.
And also the sun would be like the stage of self-sovereignty, you know?
Independence and agency. And then Mars as the age of your full strength, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jupiter, maturity and kind of having good judgment, I guess.
Yep, that makes sense as the planet of law.
Right. And then Saturn is old age, wah, wah.
Of course. Yeah. And there was something I read about, you know, these ages, and it kind of capped everything at 70 as like, that's the oldest you want to be.
Bummer.
To say if you're not 69, you know, which I'm not.
Yes,
you know
exactly.
What I mean.
I know what you mean.
They didn't have a very optimistic outlook of life after 70.
No, because people just didn't. You know,
but now you can become president, so whatever.
Yep. Well, maybe we could just like say, okay, how about 91 and each stage is 13 years?
Right,
except I think it's more like, you know, kind of like 3 decades of Saturn instead.
Yeah. Right.
That's what it seems like.
28 years of Saturn if you make it.
Oh, and then there's the 7 virtues and 7 vices and the 7 Pleiades.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the 7 sisters. Yeah, and I think one of the things that's virtues and vices.
I was going to say the virtues and vices are really interesting in terms of the minors once we start to talk about them, just because, you know, the 7 minor cards are oftentimes something you need to defeat some defect, some personal weakness, and, and or some vice that you need to overcome in order to obtain victory. And you do that through the virtues.
Yes, I think that comes through particularly in Book of Thoth, since Crowley, you know, had that very low view of sevens, plus as the shadow decan for Knights or Kings.
And yeah, I think even Eliphas Levi in his Transcendental Magic somewhere I saw, he was actually talking about the Chariot, which is the major card that has to do with, the, you know, it's number seven.
Yeah.
And he mentioned that as victories over the seven sins via the seven virtues, which I thought
that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, not to mention the seven Sephirot below the abyss, which we're constantly sort of grouping together, as opposed to the supernals. You know, one of the things that I'm sure you noticed in doing research for this is that a lot of the times when we think about seven, there's sort of like a division either into six and one or four and three.
Yeah, four and three is usually what I see, but six and one with the planets around the sun. Usually.
Exactly.
And seven is really interesting, too, because it's like they call it the unbegotten and unbegetting number. So like Venus itself, it has a little bit of association with, you know, virgins like Minerva born from Zeus's head and stuff, because it doesn't have any factors. You know
what
I mean?
Yeah, it is just truly weird. Also,
and it has both such positive and negative associations. Like, that's what I kept being struck by, is like, it's the most perfect number. It's the most evil number. You know, constantly.
Yeah, yeah, that does seem to be the case. And I think it's because, well, one way to look at it is that the six, as we talked about, represents harmony and balance. But yeah, I can never think about that phrase the same way.
I know. It cracks me up every time. I can't get over that catalog. Every time I just have to laugh because I just think it's hilarious.
So, guys, if you're not sure why we're cracking up, just listen to the Sexy Six episode. But the six, you know, because it represents balance, you add one and it's like the movement out of balance or from balance, which...
Right.
You know, really is a neutral characterization, but you can see how it could generate both virtue and vice.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. I mean, we'll see this when we talk about the paths that lead from the seventh Sephira and Netzach, that the one that goes from six to seven is death.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that is super interesting.
Because you're losing that. You're losing that perfection. Something's
yes,
dying.
Yes, exactly. And there's even that phrase that we say, I'm at sixes and sevens, which is just a way of saying I'm really out of sorts. I'm really off balance. And then the 4+3 thing is so interesting, too.
Levi also said something about that. He said that's why the number seven is sacred, because it's composed of the triad and the tetrad, which is, you know, like the three supernals and then the tetrad of tetragrammaton. So because it's the three and four, it's super sacred or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And you can also think of it as like the soul being the three plus the body, which is four, because it's made up of matter, you know, matter,
right.
Four elements.
Yep.
Yeah. Or you can think of it as four being stability and three being motion, and those two in tension with each other.
That reminds me. I think what he said about the three and the four thing, the triad and the tetrad, he called it the soul served by nature. So the soul is the three and the four elements of nature or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. The soul served by nature, yeah.
Another cool thing I ran across when I was, you know, looking at this stuff is in astrology, there's a really minor aspect when you divide the circle of 360 by seven. It's the only aspect that creates an irrational number. Septile, of course.
Septile, of course. Duh. Yeah. And what is it supposed to represent?
So it's 51.42857, et cetera, into infinity degrees apart. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because what it seems to indicate in a chart is things that are very resonant with the themes that we're going to talk about with the qualities of Netzach, which are creative inspiration. Psychicness, reality and unreality.
Yeah. Yeah.
These themes are going to come up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of cool. It's not an aspect that you tend to notice very much because it's so minor and right. such a weird number, you know?
I wonder which astrologers, you know, used it. Is it a modern thing or is it more of a traditional thing?
You know, I think a lot of people don't use many yeah. minor aspects at all, really, because
for
frankly,
sure.
there's enough to look at.
Right. And then there's the, we didn't talk about the Naples arrangement. Is it the points idea of bliss? I think
yes.
that is. Yes.
And then, yeah. and then it says in parentheses, Ananda, which
Ananda.
Is-
Ananda.
The Sanskrit or Buddhist word. It's the name of the Buddha's, like, companion, I guess, but it's also a word that means joy or bliss.
Yeah, because we have the eight is the point's idea of thought, and the nine is
and they
is
call
the,
that chit.
And then the nine is the idea of being, which is sat, and it all goes together as sat-chit-ananda.
Yeah, there's,
right, which
yeah,
is its
there's
own
a
thing.
Mm-hmm. Sanskrit saying, I think, sat-ananda-chit, and it's all about the nature of reality.
Right. So
the combination
thought,
of bliss and emotions with mind and with sat, which is like
being
itself or sometimes translated as truth. So it all has to do with these 7, 8, and 9, which are kind of part of a triad of personality on the tree of life. So they kind
they
of all go together.
Are. Yeah. Or we can think of them also as the world of Yetzirah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So clearly Crowley picked up on that. As he was devising the Naples arrangement.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think you've said before, oh, Crowley hates the sevens. But, you know, I think he says a lot of things that are negative about them. But I also see a lot of things that talk about how powerful they are.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he liked to express himself forcefully. So when you read the passages on seven in Book of Thoth, it looks as though he takes this incredibly dim view of them. But at the same time, he does have other places where he sees the mysticism and the power
yeah.
of seven.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to point out something else I found in probably one of my favorite books, 777, mm-hmm. appropriately enough. It's another essay on number. Remember a few episodes back in the numeric series, we went through an essay on number that's in the
yeah.
appendix? Well, it's not
yeah.
that one. He actually has another essay on number in the beginning of 777 under the gematria section. It was pretty interesting because for seven, this is what he said. He said, the septenary desire derived by 3 and 4, there is, however, a secondary attribution making it the holiest and most perfect of numbers. That essay starts on page 27. If anyone wants to like do homework and read it, There's another section, a little bit up forward on page 43, where he says seven is a most evil number whose perfection is impossible to attack.
The kind of inherent paradox of seven.
Right.
Yeah.
And then if you go into the gematria part of the book where there's a lot of numbers broken down into different meanings and you go to the number, it's on page 49, and you go to number 777. So it says useful in a similar way. It's talking about the previous number 741, which said useful only as a denial of unity, sometimes employed in the hope of tempting it from its lair. Useful chiefly as a denial of the unity, but sometimes employed in the hope of tempting it from its... So I guess, you know, that's very Venusian, right?
It tempting sure is.
Tempting something from
yeah.
its lair.
Can you say what edition you're using so people will be able to, you know, see if they have the same one for page numbers?
Edition, let's see. Well, this one says it was first published in 1973, retitled in 77, first paper edition 1986.
And the publisher?
Red Wheel Weiser.
Okay. Is this the white cover or a different
yep,
one?
Yep, white cover.
The white cover. Okay. All right. So that should help people find it.
Anyway, so it starts out by saying useful in a similar way as 741, but then it says, as affirming that the unity is the cliff off, but a dangerous tool, especially as it represents the flaming sword that drove man out of Eden. A burnt child dreads the fire. The devils also believe and tremble. Worse than useless unless you have it by the hilt.
Mm.
Also, 777 is the grand scale of seven, and this is useless to anyone who has not yet awakened the kundalini, the female magical soul. Note 7 as the meeting place of 3 the mother and 10 the daughter, whence Netzach is the woman, married but no more.
Though I was going to point out that whole relationship between 3 and 7 and 10 as the numbers of, you know, the sacred feminine. Well, we see 7 and 3 constantly, right, as tied together, but also adding together 3 and 7 and you get 10. So you get the mother, the, in a sense, you could almost say mother, maid, and crone in those three.
Yep.
With Binah, the three as the mother, as the crone.
You could do it either way, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But certainly 10, Malkut as the daughter. But all of them are aspects of the goddess, the triple goddess. Absolutely, I
was really also struck by the idea of 7 as, you know, a component of the flaming sword when he said, worse than useless unless you have it by the hilt. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So 7s are really negative, but they're very powerful. They're just hard to grasp.
Yeah. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is that in tarot particularly, you know, we can see that sort of 7 inflection through the 7x3 in the major arcana with, you know, the fool set aside.
Right.
So you have 7 and 7 and 7, and then the 22nd one, 0 or 22 is the fool. And that's something, you know, I was just at Northwest Tarot Symposium, and I was talking to Rachel Pollack a lot about that idea. You use the connections between the majors that are 7 apart, like, for example, the Wheel of Fortune and the Star, or the Chariot and Temperance, to draw connections between those interpretationally, which is fascinating. Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting in tarot specifically, I think, is the 7 as counterpoint to the 5. Because, you know, Kabbalistically, we're going to talk about 7 as counterpoint to 8 a lot. But it's also kind of, you know, the 5 and the 7 both look towards the 6 in their own way.
Yeah.
Whereas the 5 kind of looks ahead to it and literally strives for it. And the 7 kind of looks back and either learns or tries to hold on to the balance of the 6. It's interesting to look at 5, 6, and 7 together in tarot always.
As well as to look at 7 and 8 in their relationship. And
yeah.
I mean, I guess when we talk about the paths that connect to Netzach, we'll get more into that though.
Yeah.
It's true of every single of these, but 7 is said to be, you know, negative towards the preceding Sephiroth and positive to the following ones. And that's really interesting when we look at the majors that are on the paths that come to 7 and leave from 7.
In fact, we should go on to Kabbalah soon, but I didn't really do any research on gods and goddesses of 7, but obviously Babylon.
Yep. Obviously. I've got a few. I mean,
yeah, let's hear them.
So Hathor, Aphrodite, Nike, Minerva, Freya were a couple that came up. Obviously, Inanna and Ishtar, goddesses as well. And
yes,
as far as its male beings go, Orpheus.
Yes, that's really interesting because we often hear 7 contrasted with 8 as 7 being the Orphic path and 8 being the Hermetic path.
Mm.
That's a Kabbalistic thing. Apart from Orpheus, pretty much every name you mentioned is, you know, an aspect of the feminine divine.
Yeah, that, I mean, there's so many more that we could put here.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. That's just a glimpse, really. All right, shall we talk a little bit about the tree?
Sure. Do you want to do vices and virtues and correspondences
first,
and then go into the past?
Yeah, let's do all that, because, and I also want to just talk about the Sephira Netzach a bit, because we're going to be talking about Netzach and Hod together as well, because they really are different aspects of each other. Yeah, they are known as the, well, they're both known as armies or hosts in a way. Isn't the names of the correspondence names of each Sephira are kind of versions of each other, right? It's like Jehovah Tzabaoth for Netzach.
Sounds right.
And Elohim Tzabaoth for Hod. And both of those mean like God of armies. But why armies, right?
And the path between them is, of course,
yes,
the tower.
The tower. War, Mars, Lord of armies. But the armies that they're talking about I've gotten really interested in this. There's a hermetic Kabbalist named Colin Lowe. Do you have his book?
I don't think so.
I don't have it either. It's called Hermetic Kabbalah, but it's. I came across an article of his on Caduceus, which is the hermetic library site. It's amazing. And it was talking a little bit about, in Hermetic Kabbalah, about the idea of armies as being the plurality of consciousness that you get both in Netzach and in Hod, in the sense that, like, you know, if you think of, you know, Netzach as like all those conflicting emotions that are constantly arising
That's
and dying,
really interesting.
Isn't it? And in Hod, the kind of like, you know, the way the thoughts differentiate and multiply, you can think about the armies of Netzach almost as being like armies of wants and desires.
Exactly.
You know, warring with each
thinking.
Other. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Another thing about the two of them is that they are sometimes known as spheres of prophecy. You know, that's super interesting because Netzach is kind of like the ecstatic vision, you know, the fiery inspiration visions of God.
And that fits with that septile aspect too.
Exactly. Irrational, you know, often confused with madness, that kind of thing. Whereas Hod,
artistic inspiration itself, which has a lot to do with the seven Netzach.
Exactly. And whereas Hod is the prophecy side of it that is divination, what we do, you know, reading symbols and languages and sort of it's a more recipient kind of side of it where you are trying to interpret.
I think divination is using both. You're putting words towards intuition, things that have to do with your intuition.
Yeah.
So it involves both of those aspects of ourselves.
It does. It does. Everything's so mixed down here, so low on the tree too. But yeah, and the sort of difference between those, the words Netzach and Hod are, you know, the Netzach has this quality that besides being victory, it has elements of eternity, perfection, faith, truth, those things that bring you outside of yourself, and which is almost a definition of 6+1, right? Going outside of the integrated self.
I saw a few other titles besides the traditional, like victory and, you know, firmness and valor and triumph. I also saw glamour, which I love for
that
Venus.
Makes sense.
And the awakener, which is interesting in light of, you know, the whole Kundalini aspect of things. There was something about it's not exactly a title, but about how it's a fiery sephira. If you do any form of art, you know that there's a certain amount of inertia to overcome.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
And it's that fiery spark of inspiration that allows you to overcome that inertia that you know, gives you that delight in creation.
Right. Because you could just as well not do it.
Exactly. It's a lot easier not to do it in most cases.
And it's almost like you have to find a way to tend the fire to grow it. The virtue is unselfishness, right?
Yep.
And the vice is selfishness, which...
Or, no, unchastity or lust.
Oh, okay. I've seen it in a different way as well. This was a different site. But yeah, which is kind of similar, actually, in the sense that unselfishness is recognizing that everybody else has wants and needs, whereas unchastity or lust could be simply focusing on your own.
Yeah.
Well, as you've said before, that vices really are just an imbalance of the virtue.
Right.
You know, applied towards egotistical or egoistic.
Yeah, you could look at unchastity as, you know, instead of just being a sexual thing, as being more like an impurity, where unselfishness is really a purity.
Mm. And the vision is of beauty triumphant, which ties into that whole idea of it being the sphere of art.
Yep.
Knowing beauty and truth on an aesthetic level. Where did I run across? Was it in Garden of Pomegranates, the illusion of Netzach being projection, like psychological projection, projecting your emotions onto others?
A lot to do with polarity and projections, relationships.
It's like the mirror of Venus, but distorted.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what else is associated with Netzach correspondence.
So the cliff off were listed as ravens of dispersion.
Ooh.
Which is interesting in terms of the whole like armies and hosts and war and what happens after victory, you know?
Yeah. And ravens versus doves.
Right. Yeah, there's a whole lot of birds and, oh, this is funny. Oh, there's a whole lot of, you know, birds listed, you know, sparrows and swans and ravens and I forget what else. But this is kind of one of these things that gets Crowley labeled as a misogynist because what he said was that, you know, birds are associated with Venus because static song devoid of any intellectual.
Yeah, so, I think. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, I think that, like,
but I
if
guess
we,
I can see that, you know, because we're trying to contrast it with Hode, which is
exactly
the intellectual sphere. Like, so I can give him a little bit of a pass.
Exactly. If you replace intellectual for, like, intellectualizing, you know, like, you know, the action of the mind, the super, you know, rationalizing side of the mind. Yeah, it's true that birdsong is devoid of that kind of very human over-analytical thing that we do. Yeah, that's funny. Because we start the days of creation counting from Chesed, that makes the fourth day of creation associated with the seventh sphere. So that's the day that the sun and the moon, the lights, were created.
Ah.
So I have written down here an rose girdle lamp, which sounds like Venus, and weapon robe, splendor and glory. So I'm not sure which one's the actual weapon.
Lamp, you know? And girdle are for
Venus.
Venus as seven.
Okay.
Not Venus as empress, which is a different.
Yeah.
Probably
yeah.
similar, but you know, if you're looking at Netzach, it's the lamp and girdle.
Right.
The lamp, it was the idea, what I was reading about it was that it was the idea that love, just like artistic inspiration, must somehow be enkindled and through the action of light and bringing light to things by the magician or the practitioner. And the girdle is like the vision of beauty triumphant. It's beauty that can bind and fascinate.
Right. And part of what makes it alluring is the fact that it conceals, you know, so I think there are these themes of, you know, light and darkness, of what's hidden and what's revealed in all of these themes, really. Also, the archangel of Netzach is Haniel, or Haniel. I don't know a ton about Haniel other than I remember at one point, and I've talked about this before on the show, participating in a Haniel working, which was to incubate lucid or prophetic dreams, which seems very much of this sphere.
Yeah. I could see that.
The idea that dream being so different from divination in a way, I mean, in the sense that the divination of Hode is reading symbols and dealing with language, whereas the, you know, the prophecy associated with Netzach is trance work, really, you know, receiving visions, ecstasies, things that you can't control or articulate.
Yeah, you definitely can't control your dreams very easily.
That's for sure. All right. Let's see. Shall we start looking at cards? Do you want to talk?
Yeah, why not?
Or what about color scales? Should we do that?
Oh, colors.
First?
Yeah, we can mention the colors. So amber is the king scale color. Emerald green is the queen scale color. Bright yellow green is the prince scale color. And olive flecked gold is the princess scale or empress scale color.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
So, they're mostly greens with some golds. The colors of nature, you know, the colors of sun and growth.
Yeah, what you'd expect to see if you walk outside when things are growing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the emerald in particular is interested, the briatic or queen scale color, because that's if you combine the blue of Chesed with the yellow of Tiferet, then you get the green. Whereas if you take the red of Gevurah and combine it with the yellow of Tiferet, then you get the orange of Hode. And that's
yeah, and those are the two
colors.
Those are the two spheres that are feeding into Netzach. So it makes sense that the colors would combine in that way.
Exactly. And then we'll see with Yesod, it's the combination of Gevurah and Chesed. The red and the blue create purple. So once again, those three spheres, Netzach, Hode, and Yesod, are tied together because they're the secondary colors.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, the 7, 8, and 9 are all the secondary colors where before we were dealing with primaries.
Right. Blue, red, and yellow for Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet. So chariot and tower.
Yeah. It makes me think of wrathful goddesses or maternal and wrathful, you know?
When you look at the Chariot and the Tower and Rider-Waite-Smith, you can kind of see those themes of four and three going on. I mean, you have the four of the Chariot's breastplate with the square on it, and then the three of the three figures in it, and then the tower itself is basically a cube of matter. It's a fourfold structure, but with the three windows in it. And each of these has qualities, and you see it in Thoth as well, qualities of motion and movement, which we've kind of talked about as being a seven quality. Things are changing.
Five quality, actually.
Oh, that too. But in the sense that, like,
Mars,
it's that six plus one moving away from balance kind of a thing, taking one step away from balance. Or, you know, think of the seven. We talked about the four is a stability and the three is motion. What happens when you put them together? The tension that arises from that.
I mean, six and the one can also be it's interesting because it can be either. It can be a step away from balance, or it can be, you know, the sun in the center with the planets around it. Like that another seven letter word, actually, Ararita, the formula, has the planets around the central sun.
You know, it's funny. We've talked about, I was just thinking about that because about the whole movement thing, because we've talked about threes as movement, fives as movement, and now sevens as movement. It's sort of like every odd number has that quality.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the thing about the Chariot is that there's motion and stillness combined in it, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in every version of the Chariot, because it's, in some ways, the vehicle is an internal journey, as in the idea of Merkaba mysticism, which we talked about, I think, in the Chariot episode. The vehicle, although we use it mundanely to represent movement and cars and getting places, it's also that internal journey, that internal quest for the Grail, that internal mission which you're charged with.
It's also, like, interesting that both the Chariot and the Tower, obviously the Tower, have a lot to do with Mars, either by their attributions or their placement on the tree, whereas this, you know, they're also associated with seven, Venus. So there's this, I don't know, there's this interesting relationship here about how the sevens are victory and then these very martial forces.
So the Chariot's placement on the tree, which you're talking about, is that relationship between Givura and Binah. So it does connect between Saturn and Mars. On the other hand, it's Cancer, where Mars is fallen. Yeah, so there's that sort of tension between Mars triumphant and Mars struggling. Oh, and also, you know, the Tower, it's fascinating to me because we've talked about the Tower as that path which intersects with the path of temperance or art, and that at the intersection is where you're supposed to be speaking your lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram, because, you know, the tower is pay, the mouth.
And think about what you're doing there. You're basically banishing from connection with things you don't want connected to you.
And you're standing in this place that's right balance between Netzach and Hod, between, you know, the emotions and the reason. You know, it just seems like a place where, you know, you're dealing with the kind of explosive force of Netzach, the getting the irrational force, and then the side of Hod trying to articulate and rationalize that, and somewhere in between that tension creates the Tower experience. In terms of other majors that are connected to Netzach.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were talking about paths into and paths out of Netzach earlier.
Right. So coming into, we have Netzach, we have death coming from Tiferet and the wheel coming from Hesed, which, you know, that's like death being a part of love and life and change being a part of love and life, you know?
Particularly the death one, which is that combination of six plus seven and really embodies the difference between them.
Yeah, Crowley somewhere in, I don't know if it was in Book of Thoth, I think so, he makes a big deal about the connection between Netzach and the life and love and the idea of death. He actually has this one section that he points out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different essays in the Book of Lies, all which reference the connection between love and death. Which were really interesting. So it was number 1, 8, 15, 16, and 18. So basically the Magus, Adjustment, the Devil, the Tower, and the Moon all have sections in the Book of Lies where it really references this connection between the idea of death being a part of love and life.
Yeah, for love to be continuous, for life to be continuous, there has to be the cycle of death that kind of dances in tandem with it.
Right. Yeah, the wheel.
Exactly.
So those are the things feeding in to Netzach. Mm-hmm. And then what's coming out of it, we have the Tower, as we've talked about, heading towards Hode. And we have, well, depending on...
depending on your system.
We have either the Emperor in Thoth-based or the Star going into Yesod. And I was thinking of that as well. If it's the Emperor or the Star, either way, it's a form of like structure or ideals that you have to apply to your artistic inspirations, you know? And then the Moon is the card that connects Netzach to Malkuth. And that's really interesting because of the, you know, the whole glamour and imagination thing.
I see that as well. I mean, I kind of think of those five cards coming into and out of Netzach as all versions of going beyond your boundaries of your what quote unquote normal self, like especially if you think about glamour in the Moon as kind of going beyond reality, going between those pillars to something beyond. And if you think of the Star or the Emperor, you know, the Star allows you to aspire beyond your place, and the Emperor kind of represents the authority that gives you something that's greater than yourself to work for or fight for.
It's also striking how three, I mean, if you use the Emperor anyway, three of those majors are martial. So we have Scorpio ruled by Mars, we have Mars itself, and we have Aries ruled by Mars.
Yeah, yeah.
Connecting to Venus.
Yeah, and they all have that sort of weird relationship to the ego, where the Emperor kind of represents the ego given agency and power, but the Tower is the destruction of the ego, and the Death card is kind of surrendering
letting go
up
of the ego.
Yeah. And each of those, you know, is a negotiation going beyond the ego in some way. Whereas the Wheel of Fortune, in terms of the ego or the self and what it seeks, is kind of looking above, looking up to the divine for assistance, for mercy, for that which you can't provide for yourself, so you look to Providence to provide it for you.
And then the other two cards, you know, Fortune, that aren't the martial ones, Fortune and the Moon, you know, the Moon as Pisces, that's ruled by Jupiter, the Fortune card. So we have like two very kind of Jupiter, the greater Fortune aspects of that. And then we have, you know, martial stuff coming out the other end.
Yeah, coming out the other end, exactly. Yeah, on the Pillar of Force, the positive experiences are represented from Netzach as the Fortune and the Moon cards, whereas the more stressful experiences could be represented by the
Martial ones.
I don't
know if I'd call the Moon
ones.
Card all that positive.
Well, yes, I was sort of thinking about this because I just recently, as you might expect, the Wheel of Fortune and Pisces Nine of Cups post, and I was thinking if you combine those together, you get that aspect of the Moon which governs Fortune.
Well, and you know what's really interesting about the Moon card in relationship to the sevens is that, you know, we talked about sevens as desires, but they also have a lot to do with, I guess you would call it, group consciousness. And the Moon card is kind of like that too, I think.
Yeah, certainly the collective unconscious is in there,
right?
There's
a connection there for sure. Like, and the sevens are instinct, and where does instinct come from but from the subconscious?
Right. And the dogs of the Moon are, you know, right there,
right,
representing our animal instincts. All right, should we look at minors?
Yep.
I'm going to read a little bit of Crowley, I guess, where he says that he talks about sevens as being doubly unbalanced, a frantic struggle, a descent into illusion. He talks about Venus as being her greatest crisis is being lost from her heavenly origin. So Venus as
right,
Netzach.
So that's like the difference between Venus as Netzach and Venus as the Empress, which is, you know, up there with the Supernals.
Yeah, and he talks about it as being the degeneration of the element in each of these four, and its utmost weakness. And I think, you know, even when you think about the sevens as a contrast to the five, they have that quality of, oh my God, I've just left the six and what am I going to do?
Now
things are all screwed up. But at the same time,
gotta get back to that harmony and balance.
But I think also, you know, kind of in the way that Chesed, you know, is the, represents the loss of the bliss of the supernals and the perfection of the supernals, but it's the source for everything else. The seven, I think, represents the loss of the six, but also the ability of the self to fend for itself, to do things individually, to seek, to gain skills. So there is a positive side to sevens in that sense.
Remember where I got this quote, but maybe Wang, I'm not sure, but it said for the sevens, it said, and this kind of reminds me of that other thing about the flaming sword, but It called the seven a force like unto a crown, powerful but requiring one capable of wearing it, results dependent on action taken.
That sounds familiar. I can't remember where it's from.
Could be Wang. Yeah. But
Wang. Yeah.
If we think about both that, like grasping the sword by the hilt idea or being capable of wearing this force and results dependent on actions taking, it really, when you look at these four seven cards, they are all dependent, getting out of the quagmire or whatever is going on in these cards, all are like that. You have to take action.
Individual action. Yeah.
Towards, to fight these defects and achieve victory. It's dependent on what actions you take, whether you're going to succeed or not.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you look at the Seven of Wands, both in Thoth and Rider-Waite, you know, you see it's that six against one kind of formula where there are six that are alike and one that is different, attacking the one. And in the case, I think, of Thoth, he says that patriotism is not enough. So there's that club in the center, that brutish sort of rough club in the center, represents the need to push beyond high principle, I think. And
right, and it's interesting in terms of the ruler of the Deccan for the Seven of Wands is Mars.
Right.
So this struggle is a battle of, you know, will. That's what I would call it.
In Rider-Waite Smith, he says that, you know, he talks about, again, that same struggle, but he says that the Seven of Wands figure has the vantage. He has the high point. So it suggests that success or victory is going to come after a struggle. It's also, most people say that this figure is probably Petruchio from Taming of the Shrew, which we talk about in some detail in the Seven of Wands. But the idea that, you know, someone who is an outsider, who's got mismatched shoes, who's kind of a hot mess, it takes that kind of thinking outside of the box to achieve victory in these circumstances.
And yeah, I would say thinking outside of the box is more the Seven of Swords, but
it's a seven quality generally. I mean, one of the things that Crowley says is that the Seven of Swords is incapable of sustained labor, but on the other hand, it's not going to be confined by its expectations. So this is, what does he call it? The rheumatic boxer trying to stage a comeback.
Yeah.
And
it points back to the Deccan ruler of the moon and its, you know, inherent fluctuation and supposed instability.
And supposed instability. Yeah. Yeah. I think Waite also says it's a plan that may fail. One thing about that Seven of Swords that we see is that there is a restlessness, but also a willingness to kind of try anything, you know, may not work, but let's give it a try. You know, with the Seven of Cups, This is interesting. Waite calls it the glass of contemplation. So that's a Venus mirror type thing, right?
Yeah, and Venus is the ruler of that decan. So that this is exactly. Like the most important seven in one sense.
Right. It's a Kabbalistic double, like all the other Scorpio cards, because it's seven as Netzach, but also Venus as ruler. Yeah, images of fantastic spirit is what Waite says, while Crowley says it's a false pleasure, or he says earth churned into the scorpion morass.
Because it's, lovely. You know, doubly Venus and it's a defect, I think of it as a defect of desire. You're seeing what you want to see.
Or
like we talked about. Or
and yet, I think that fault, that flaw or vice is necessary in order to get to the truth in art, right? Because the truth in art is a fictional truth, but it's a truth nonetheless. Mm-hmm. So I feel as though that's part of the secret of sevens, that the truth is in there. It's just hidden and warped.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And then the Lord
Seven
of Failure.
Of
yay. The labor itself is abandoned, says Crowley. The extreme of passivity, because it's Saturn, right? It's
right.
Super slow. Saturn in Taurus, Saturn in this earth sign. Waite says something weird about this, which is like, these were his treasure. He's looking at the pentacles as if these were his treasures and his heart was there. So that kind of speaks to the desire nature of the seven. But, you know, it's almost as if they're his treasures, but he doesn't know what's going on with them. And my experience of that card has been that it always involves slowdowns, just slowdowns and delays and things being
held the
up.
Action of Saturn applied to the material world where we're supposed to take action isn't always helpful, or definitely not lending itself towards any type of speed.
Yeah, and so it's sort of like, there's always the question with the seven of, you can take action, is it the wisest course, though?
Yeah.
And with the seven of pentacles, I think, although action may be called for, there's also a quality of, well, you should also be patient, because otherwise you may not find the right way to act and you may regret it.
Mm.
And also the fact that all of these cards are shadow decans of the Nitre King.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. So shadow decan, last of the fixed signs, but the court card that they belong to is the mutable court, the knights or kings. So their motivation or their point of weakness has to do with the fact that they know that the seven, that experience of the seven of trying and failing, of desire and suffering from desire, is part of that, you know, shadow nature of the knight or king.
Mm-hmm.
And what part of what in his central decan, the eight, he tries to, you know, at his best, he has a system. He has an order. He you know, he has a plan. Which I guess we'll get to when we get to the eight. All right. What else have we got here?
That might be,
be it.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
I do have one more thing that maybe we could end with that I thought was really good. So, actually two things.
All right.
So, one is just a reflection that, you know, seven is associated with Venus. That's love. And then there's Crowley's famous seven words. Love is the law, love under will.
Mm-hmm.
And then this really striking quote that is so appropriate for our times right now. It's from the Great Law of the Iroquois Confederacy. That is, in our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next seven generations.
Oh, wow. That's great. Yeah. And also, you know, kind of at this moment, I've been thinking about, we're all thinking about, which is the coronavirus crisis, and how, in a way, you
know,
group consciousness, but also kind of a system failure in a way, you know,
yes.
but it's the one of my colleagues.
Weaknesses to be defeated. You know, we're seeing the weaknesses in our collective systems.
That's right. But also, one of my colleagues described it as the revenge of ecology. You know, the idea that nature is having the last word here. Nature is saying, okay, you destroy my planet. I will make it so you can't travel.
It's not nice to mess with Mother Nature.
That's right. I will protect the young people. They won't get sick. But, you know, all of you who are abusing me, you know, this is going to be the price you pay. I don't know. There's definitely something in here about the peril and danger and corrective action of Seven that we're all experiencing, alas, at some level. Also the hysteria, I have to say.
Well, we're going to, in the next episode, we'll move on to the eights, and those are the plans, and those are the corrections to to the defects or the remedies to the Seven. So,
right.
Let's hopefully we get there collectively as well.
The infrastructural remedies of the eight. So some of the, just to wrap up some of the themes we've talked about Seven as emotions, as inspirations.
As desire and feelings and awakening delight in creation.
Creativity and artistic endeavors, eternity, the strength of the individual, the four and the three, the six and the one. You don't hear so much about the five and the two, though, which is weird. The virtue of unselfishness, visions of beauty, prophecy.
The fiery sword.
Fiery sword.
Flaming sword of creation.
The armies and hosts, plurality of consciousness.
Yeah, results dependent on actions taken.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
I think that wraps it up. All right. So thanks for sticking with us in this trying time, everybody. And we will be back with you next time with the systems and infrastructure of the eight. See you then.